Hi, welcome again to Radio Northern Beaches 88.7 and 90.3 and streaming live on our website rnb.org.au. Once again, this is Innovation Talk and I'm Michael Lester. And in our talk today, we're going to be looking at the issue of open access and open science arrangements for collaboration, particularly in the context of the search for a COVID-19 vaccine. I think we've all been struck by how fast it appears that scientists have got together and collaborated on a global scale, sharing information and research towards looking for a vaccine, and how very quickly through that process of openness we seem to have got to a point where there are any number of already vaccine testing things running, including on humans, although obviously it's still some time far away to getting it manufactured and distributed to everyone. That's even assuming that these come through. On the program today, delighted to welcome back to Innovation Talk Professor Virginia Ginny Barbara from QUT, who heads up the Open Access Task Force in Australia, which is a movement that's been working for some time out of the universities and research organisations to promote a more open approach to the sharing of information and data by scientists. So welcome again to Innovation Talk, Ginny.
Delighted to be here.
When we spoke on what seems a long time ago now, I think it was 18 months ago, about the open access movement that you're involved in, including particularly here in Australia, you were telling us about the objectives of that. Could you just briefly recap for us what the basic concept is behind open access?
Yeah, so the idea behind open access to research is that research is, when it's published, is freely available for everyone to read immediately. But it also is available in such a way that it can be built on, that it can be reused, and that requires it, for example, to have associated open licenses with the research paper so that it's very clear what can be done with it afterwards. And that also means that not only can academics read it, but also, for example, it can be incorporated into course materials at universities. So it's the idea that once research is done, that it's shared quickly and immediately and openly with anyone that wants to read it.
Right. Now, the fact that there is a global movement, including a movement here in Australia, towards open access would suggest that the existing system of the handling of scientific research results and data is quite a different model. Can you briefly explain to us how what operates now as the model and why we need an open access approach?
Yes, well, the traditional way of sharing research has been through journals, which until not very long ago actually were paper journals that were distributed through subscriptions, and universities would subscribe to those journals, and that's how everybody would get access to them, or really the people that were able to be in institutions where they could buy the access. Of course, we live in a digital world nowadays, and it's very easy to quickly share information, but unfortunately we still have a business model that's primarily based on sharing through print subscriptions. And in Australia, currently, those subscriptions costs are very high. Australian universities pay around $300 million per year to access journals, and that doesn't include the people where the subscriptions, for example, that are paid at universities or even individual subscriptions. So a lot of money goes into making these this research publicly available, but at the same time, a lot of money also goes into actually having to buy back that research for academics and others to read.
Yeah, which is an interesting business model, isn't it? Because I guess we have a global scientific academic publishing industry with lots of journals which are used for peer review processes in the science process, making very, huge companies really, and making very, very large profits off the back, it might be said, of what is largely publicly funded research, which costs them nothing, which they then take to make a profit out of. I think in Australia, just alone from a couple of our research funding arms, the ARC, the Research Council, National Health and Medical Research Council, we're heading for $1.5 to $2 billion a year of taxpayer money, let alone the other money we put into scientific research elsewhere. And yet this work is being taken, and in a sense, its accessibility and publication is controlled by huge profit-making global corporations. Isn't that right?
Majority of publishing is done by a relatively small number of companies, and they do have a very very large say in the kind of the global publishing industry. There are a number of smaller players, of course, including university presses and publishing houses owned by societies, and those are also increasingly important. But yes, it's true that the vast majority of publishing, and indeed the infrastructure behind publishing, is owned by a relatively small number of companies.
So to reshape that system from a scientific research point of view, to put in place the sort of principles that you've been speaking about of open access to publicly funded research, is going to require major systemic change, isn't it, in the way things are done, including particularly in the financing and the incentivization of individual institutions and researchers.
Yeah, that's right. And, I mean, we know, for example, there is enough money in the system to make research openly available. There's been some good studies done from Europe that are well established, that we now have enough money in the system to make research open at the point of publication. But unfortunately, as you say, what happens now is that the money that is goes to fund research is paid separately from the money that goes to publish research, and there's no global coordination of that, and there's certainly no national coordination of that. And the other point, as you absolutely make clear, is that the journals that individual academics publish in, they are perceived by academics to be variously prestigious or not, and a large amount of people's careers are based on where they publish at the moment. And universities also have a high are very interested in knowing where individuals publish, because that's how universities themselves get ranked. So the whole publishing system is very complex. It's tied up with the status of researchers. It's tied up with the status of universities. And it's hard to unpick that without taking a sort of global and indeed, you know, certainly a national approach.
Yeah, and when we last spoke, I think 18 months ago or so, you were involved with a coalition or alliance of various institutions and funders in Australia who are making their own individual commitments. I think at the time or now, the Research Council, which is a big funder, and the NHMRC are sort of committed to these principles of open access, I believe, and maybe many other organisations, and there is an Australian Research Data Commons. But you were calling at the time and hopeful of some moves towards a more national approach. How much have we been able to move forward down this path over the past 18 months in Australia?
Well, the first thing I would say is that the group that I direct, the Australasian Open Access Strategy Group, we've grown in size. We've now got 20 universities in Australia support us, as well as all of the 8 New Zealand universities. So we have a good coalition that is working towards this. We work very closely with the ARC and the NHMRC, and we talk with them regularly. And I would say that there are some really thoughtful conversations going on at the moment. The ARC and the NHMRC have both had open access policies in place since 2012, 2013. But those policies don't require immediate open access. They require that research is made available, but only after 12 months after publication. So it's not the immediate access that we would really like to see. But there's no question that initiatives that are happening globally, such as Plan S, which is an initiative that's started in Europe and that is gaining traction, is causing pretty much every institution, every funder to look closely at, you know, how they might align with that, and or how they might think about moving towards that, even if they're not able to sort of fully align with it.
Right. Now, in a recent article that you've written, and I believe it was commissioned, wasn't it, by the Australian Academy of Sciences, you've written about the concept of open science, and particularly in the context of the moves that are happening towards collaboration, if you like, on search for a new vaccine internationally. What's the motivation for writing that paper?
We were considering writing something like this when the Academy of Science commissioned us to write on it, so the timing was very good. I mean, I think that there's no doubt that the current pandemic has really focused everyone's attention on how we need to do research, that there's no question that we need to, research needs to happen quickly, it needs to happen collaboratively, it needs to happen internationally. This disease started in China, but very rapidly became worldwide, and research from every single country has been incredibly valuable in in developing, not just moving towards a vaccine, but understanding the early symptoms, sequencing the virus and developing early treatments, and indeed, running trials and such like. And it's incredible to see how much of an international collaborative effort this has been. And this has happened because, there's no question, because sharing of results at an early stage, sharing of data, has been going on behind the scenes and also at the time of publication in a way that I think is almost unprecedented. Just to give you one example, we see an enormous number of results shared through preprint servers now, which are early reports of research that have not been peer-reviewed, but are incredibly valuable for other researchers to be able to see what work is going on and to analyse it and to then lead to the next discovery. So this sharing has been quite unprecedented. It also has shown us the importance of properly open science, so not just making articles free to read, but also making them available with a licence so that they can be used and queried by machines and by other technologies, not just individuals who need to read the research papers. So as we said in the article, it's really like a real-time lesson in how to do research.
Well, that's a very encouraging picture, and that seems certainly to be the case, given the rapid rate at which, as I mentioned earlier, and as we're all aware, I think, the number of vaccines around the world that are moving into very, very early testing, when these things and processes normally take much longer. I guess there are some potential downside risks in early release of data, particularly in this sort of field, aren't there? Am I mistaken in thinking that I saw some comments from the Chief Scientist of Australia warning that perhaps we needed to be a little cautionary about early releasing and wide releasing of early information and data on these researches for a vaccine, or was I mistaken?
I mean, I'll give you one example as to why I think what's happening now is better than before. We'll probably remember, many people will remember the SARS outbreak of 2003, which was actually a relatively short-lived outbreak compared to what looks like the current pandemic is going to be. It lasted about 7 months, but an analysis that we quote in our article shows that most of the research that was done on SARS was actually published after the SARS outbreak finished. So only 7% of research on SARS was published whilst the outbreak was actually happening. Now, to compare that to today, where the vast majority of research is coming out almost in real time, I absolutely agree with the Chief Scientist. These are not results that should lead anybody to change the way they behave or change the way that, for example, doctors treat people tomorrow. But having that research out there means that other researchers can actually scrutinise the research very quickly and immediately. And there's no question that some of the results that come out will not be ones that stand up long term to scrutiny, but others will, and I think it's much better to have them out there than sitting in people's bottom drawers not being published.
Yes, well, that sounds a quite reasonable position. I mean, at the other end of the spectrum almost on this issue, we have been rather fortunate, I believe, in the context of the current research situation for a vaccine, that from a very early stage, a few months back in fact, that the DNA sequence of the COVID-19 virus, if you like, was both determined and made globally publicly available. Is that the case? Because as I understand, in earlier pandemics, and certainly if you go back a long time, Spanish flu and all the rest of it, all the research would have been done in almost complete ignorance of the nature of the beast that they were trying to tackle, whereas at least here they seem to have a very clear idea through the genetic sequencing DNA that's been released of what they're trying to tackle.
Yeah, well, so the thing about coronavirus, which it is absolutely, we knew very early on that it was an RNA virus, we knew very early on what the sequence of it was, and in fact, not only do we know what the first sequence was, it's been possible to sequentially published sequences of different viruses from different populations because it has evolved somewhat. I mean, genetics is a really interesting example of a field where sharing of research has been the case for a very long time. GenBank, which is the international repository for genetic material, has been open for a very, very long time. And you'd be unlikely to publish any kind of research on a new genetic of any new genetic area where you didn't publish the research, the sequence itself. So that has always been the norm, and you're absolutely right. That's been completely critical to our understanding of what this virus is. I mean, there's no question that we would be back at square one if we hadn't had that information very early on, and it was shared incredibly quickly by the researchers in China, and then built on by researchers globally.
Yeah, listeners, you're with Innovation Talk on Radio Northern Beaches, and I'm speaking with our guest, Professor Virginia Ginny Barber from the Queensland University of Technology, about the topic of open science and how it contributes to global collaboration on research and research results and data, particularly in the context of the search for a COVID-19 vaccine, an issue dear to all of our hearts, I'm sure, at this point. On this question of the DNA sequencing that's available, I think you're making the point that that's generally open access available and pretty early in the piece. Do we actually know, just as a matter of a detail and aside, where that sequencing work has been done? Was it done in Australia or in America or in China or everywhere or nowhere or in particular? Or
coronavirus has been done repeatedly by many, many different groups, from the first groups that identified it in China through to, for example, if there's a new outbreak, one can trace the kind of the origins and the spread of it by looking at the RNA sequence as it moves through the population. So yes, it's been done repeatedly by multiple groups. And as you pointed out earlier, the fact that that's been shared is incredibly important, because it means that you can then check back against other groups to see whether the results that you're finding are kind of relevant and coherent to what's been found before.
Now, thinking back over quite a while of Australian research and science and results, I can remember over the years, maybe decades, from time to time, criticisms are made in the context of the innovation performance of the Australian economy, that we fund a lot of public research, and particularly in the CSIRO, but some people have said, oh, we rushed to publish all that stuff in journals and openly, so anyone anywhere around the world could get all this stuff and capitalise on it, and that we, in a sense, the implication was, by not holding on to it and perhaps not even getting patents and intellectual property rights, we're somehow giving away the fruits of our Australian-funded research. Is this a balancing issue? Is this an issue in making data openly available and quickly to everyone? The commercial issue of intellectual property protection?
Pandemic is not the time to be holding on to intellectual property. We absolutely need to have all the information out there as quickly as we can, so that whoever needs it can have that information to build on it. It's certainly true that there are a lot of research will lead to intellectual property and patents, and that's okay. But in the end, even for those issues where you do develop a patent, you're going to have to want that research to be scrutinised. You need to know, for example, the patent is built on reliable science. So it's not necessarily a contradiction that you having a patent and having research that's openly available. It's a question of balancing it. I would say there's one other issue, though, to think about when releasing research very widely, and particularly around data, is that there are a set of principles that have been developed around thinking about openness of research, in its relevance to Indigenous data, where there are specific issues that one has to think very carefully about making research open, and some of that is around allowing, ensuring that whoever where the data come from, that those individuals have control over that data. And so it's not as simple as saying we should throw everything open with no controls. There absolutely needs to be controls, but at the same time, the balance most of the time is towards making things more open, and certainly at a time of emergencies like this.
Yes, well, as you say, at the heart, I suppose, of the scientific method is this element of making data and methodologies available so that these can be validated and reproduced, because that's, isn't it, the heart of the scientific method and its validation. If I just may, as a small aside, because I find it quite fascinating, in the digital age, the age of algorithms, it does seem that these algorithms are being patented and intellectual property is being taken out, and that access, open access to the data sets and the algorithms themselves is very highly opaque. Is that an issue of any concern or inconsistency with an open access approach?
Algorithms are actually a way, you know, algorithms have, in many ways have shown the importance of open access, because if you are wanting, say, to search a large amount of data or a large number of publications, that can't be done by an individual. It has to be done by a computer. And computers are trained to look for information which has certain attributes, so the metadata around the data, you know, whether or not you, you know, where it comes from, what the license is to share it, you know, what its original provenance is. And so to some extent, algorithms are actually a very good example of why open access matters, rather than being a sort of a barrier. But of course, you can, you know, you can patent the algorithms themselves, and there's no doubt that some very clever research is being done on top of open access data sets, which will end up with some sort of new ways of analysing research.
Yeah, I think you mentioned earlier that at this time of global pandemic is no time for researchers and others to be worrying about intellectual property, that we should all be contributing to the commons and the public good, and I'm sure that's a very true statement. And yet there are always tensions, aren't there, in the real world and in politics and economics. For example, even within the COVID context, aren't we seeing moves by large economies and rich countries to even monopolise access to potential vaccines and certainly already to equipment and whatever. So I wonder to what extent that motivates that sort of behaviour rather than a global commons and sharing approach, and whether that you may have any impact on the open access to research that we've been talking about.
Yeah, it's very interesting watching this, the sort of, you know, political movings that's going on. But I mean, I'm not privy to any of those conversations, obviously. But my impression would be that the researchers are themselves sharing the data and they're sharing their research. And I would hope that the political kind of issues are left out of it. I mean, I think I think it would be unlikely if there isn't much sharing that happens simply because of sort of political issues that are happening at a, you know, the level of sort of finances and such like. Certainly what we've seen is there's been an outpouring of research from every country, and that the vast majority of people doing the research and groups are sharing it pretty freely.
Yes, well, sadly, politics can often get in the way of more principled, perhaps, approaches around science and ideas of collaboration and openness and sharing, which is, after all, at the end of the day, at the heart of good scientific method, isn't it? And we, even in Australia at the moment, perhaps as an observation, for national security reasons, it seems, not even for economic, perhaps, are concerned about some of the collaborations that our universities are undertaking with foreign students and researchers from China. So clearly a lot of political things, from the economic and commercial right through to security and defence, can sort of interpose themselves in this debate and move about global scientific cooperation and open access, can't they?
Right, but at the same time, and there are some you know, laws around that, the Defence Controls Act, which regulate that, for example, particular research and how it's done and how it's managed. And of course, universities are incredibly aware of and manage that very carefully. But I think that most of the time, most of the research that's done doesn't fall into that category. And provided you're aware of those policies and you adhere to them, it's not generally a barrier to sharing of research.
Yeah. Well, moving to the positive ground again, which we're seeing, there is concerted global action, as I think I mentioned up the top of this program. We've got this $8 billion fund that people have now committed to globally, including Australia, to the tune of $300 or $400 million in the COVID humanitarian response, I guess. And also we have a thing from the World Bank, don't we, the Coalition for Epidemic Preparedness and Innovation, CPI, which has been, you know, basically there to fund the development and share the information and research on vaccines. So one might hope, that these international moves might move us into a more open access scientific regime, particularly in the coronavirus situation.
New. I mean, the Coalition for Epidemic Preparedness has been in place for some time, and is one of the reasons why, for example, that various groups were able to move quickly to share research. I think that we've got with every pandemic or every kind of health emergency, the technology gets better. I think that's been one of the things this time. So, for example, we have very good ways of sharing research. Early, much better ways that we had a few years ago, and the ability to query the data sets is also much better, the type of algorithms you talked about earlier. I mean, I think the thing I find the most hopeful is, to some extent, it's, you know, the money obviously is great, but the most important thing, I think, is the fact that it signals an interest and a willingness of countries to cooperate to manage this. Pandemic, and I think that's probably the most hopeful thing that I see coming out of this.
Great. So as we close here, I wonder how optimistic you are that as we progress through this COVID situation from a research and science point of view, and as we come out the back end, as some of the people say, into some sort of new normality, that we will take the opportunity provided by this experience to, I think in your words, refashion the scientific research system and its approach towards a more open system. Are you optimistic? And what would be the next steps that would be necessary in Australia?
Yeah, I am optimistic. And I actually think that, in particular, you know, some of the moves that we've seen by publishers have been more positive than before. And I think we're seeing, you know, perhaps less of a decision by them to close off research, off access to research once this is all over. I think they are beginning, I think, to look at the longer term rather than just the short term. I think that in Australia, as in many countries, we need a proper open science strategy, which includes access to publications, data, software, and the infrastructure. And I think that needs to be coordinated across all the different agencies that need to be involved with that. I also think that a part of that has to be a serious rethinking of how the funds flow through the system in order to ensure that, you know, we make research openly available up front rather than having to buy it back afterwards, which is the current system. So my main hope is that we'll move towards a national approach once this is all over.
Well, thank you very much, Professor Ginny Barber from Queensland University of Technology, for joining us here on Radio Northern Beaches Innovation Talk to talk about the very topical issue of open access and open science in the context of the COVID-19 vaccine research search. Thank you very much, and this is Michael Lester signing off, and hoping listeners you can join me again next week. Thank you, Virginia. Ginny?
Thank you very much for the opportunity.
Listeners, if I may, here is a correction. I referred mistakenly on a couple of occasions during that interview of mine to the DNA coronavirus, whereas it should correctly be referred to as the RNA virus. My apologies for that.